This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents Titan, The Life of John D. Rockefeller Sr. by Ron Chernow. This book is read by Grover Gardner. Dedication. To my brother, Dr. Bart Chernow, who pulled me back at the last moment from the brink, and to the lovely Valerie. Two men have been supreme in creating the modern world, Rockefeller and Bismarck. One in economics, the other in politics, refuted the liberal dream of universal happiness through individual competition, substituting monopoly and the corporate state, or at least movements toward them. Bertrand Russell, Freedom versus Organization, 1814 to 1914. Something in the nature of J.D. Rockefeller had to occur in America, and it is all to the good of the world that he was tight-lipped, consistent, and amazingly free from vulgar vanity, sensuality, and quarrelsomeness. His cold persistence and ruthlessness may arouse something like horror, but for all that, he was a forward-moving force, a constructive power. H.G. Wells, The Work, Wealth, and Happiness of Mankind. When history passes its final verdict on John D. Rockefeller, it may well be that his endowment of research will be recognized as a milestone in the progress of the race. Science today owes as much to the rich men of generosity and discernment as the art of the Renaissance owes to the patronage of popes and princes. Of these rich men, John D. Rockefeller is the supreme type. Winston Churchill, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, July 8, 1936. Rockefeller, you know, is reputed the richest man in the world, and he certainly is the most powerfully suggestive personality I have ever seen. A man 10 stories deep, and to me quite unfathomable. Physiognomie de Pierrot, not a spear of hair on head or face. Flexible, cunning, Quakerish, superficially suggestive of naught but goodness and conscientiousness, yet accused of being the greatest villain in business whom our country has produced. William James, in a letter to Henry James, January 29, 1904. Forward. The life of John Davison Rockefeller Sr. was marked to an exceptional degree by silence, mystery, and evasion. Even though he presided over the largest business and philanthropic enterprises of his day, he has remained an elusive figure, a master of disguises. He spent his life camouflaged behind multiple personae and shrouded beneath layers of mythology. Hence, he lingers in our national psyche as a series of disconnected images, ranging from the rapacious creator of Standard Oil, brilliant but bloodless, to the wizened old codger dispensing dimes and canned speeches for newsreel cameras. It is often hard to piece together the varied images into a coherent picture. This has not been for lack of trying. Earlier in the century, Rockefeller inspired more prose than any other private citizen in America, with books about him tumbling forth at a rate of nearly one per year. As he was the most famous American of his day, his statements and actions were reported and analyzed minutely in the press. Yet even in his heyday of popular interest, he could seem maddeningly opaque, with much of his life unfolding behind the walls of his estates and the frosted glass doors of his office. Rockefeller often seems to be missing from his own biographies, flitting through them like a ghostly, disembodied figure. For the principal muckrakers, such as Henry Demarest Lloyd and Ida Tarbell, he served as shorthand for the Standard Oil Trust, his personality submerged in its machinations. Even in the 2-volume biography by Alan Nevins, who strove to vindicate Rockefeller's reputation, Rockefeller vanishes for pages at a time amid a swirl of charges and countercharges. The attention paid to the depredations of Standard Oil has tended to overshadow everything else about Rockefeller's life. H.G. Wells defended this biographical approach. The life history of Rockefeller is the history of the trust. He made it, and equally it made him, so that apart from its story, it seems hardly necessary to detail his personal life in chronological order. So steadfastly have biographers clung to this dated view that we still lack an account of our foremost 19th-century industrialist, that explores his inner and outer worlds and synthesizes them into a fully rounded portrait. For all the ink provoked by Rockefeller, his biographies have been marred by a numbing repetition. Whatever their political slant, they have, on the whole, followed the same chronology, raked over the same disputes about his business methods, rehashed the same stale anecdotes. One has the impression of sitting through the same play over and over again, albeit from slightly different seats in the theater. Some of this derives from our shifting conception of biography. With the exception of John D., a slender volume by David Freeman Hawke published in 1980, the Rockefeller biographies were all published before mid-century and betray a Victorian reticence about private matters. Whatever their merits as business reportage, they betray minimal post-Freudian curiosity. They touch only glancingly, for instance, on the story of Rockefeller's father, a bigamist and snake oil salesman, who so indelibly shaped his son's life. Even the exhaustive Nevins showed scant interest in Rockefeller's marriage or his three daughters. The feminist concerns of our own day have recently produced two books, Bernice Kurtz, Abby Aldrich Rockefeller, and Clarice Statz's The Rockefeller Women, that have begun to pry open this hermetically sealed family world. Rockefeller's social life beyond the office, his friendships, hobbies, sports, etc., has suffered from equally conspicuous neglect. Other matters that warrant investigation include Rockefeller's political views and theory of trusts, his attitude toward public relations, his stewardship of his investments beyond Standard Oil, his transfer of money to his children and his dynastic ambitions, his persistent fascination with medicine, and the imprint he left upon the many philanthropies he endowed. There has also been a remarkable lack of curiosity about the 40-odd years that he spent in retirement, with some biographers omitting those decades altogether. Yet it was during those decades that John D. Rockefeller Jr. both perpetuated and radically modified his father's legacy, a subject to which I devote considerable attention. When Random House proposed that I write the first full-length biography of Rockefeller since Alan Nevins's in the 1950s, I frankly balked, convinced that the subject had been exhausted by writers too eager to capitalize on his fame. How could one write about a man who made such a fetish of secrecy? In the existing literature, he came across as a gifted automaton at best, a malevolent machine at worst. I couldn't tell whether he was a hollow man, deadened by the pursuit of money, or someone of great depth and force but with eerie self-control. If the former was true, I would respectfully decline. In the unlikely case that the latter proved true, well, then I was intrigued. To settle the matter, I spent a day at the Rockefeller Archive Center in Sleepy Hollow, New York, the repository of millions of family documents. When I told the curators of my misgivings and explained that I couldn't write about Rockefeller unless I heard his inner voice, the music of his mind, as I phrased it, they brought me the transcript of an interview privately conducted with Rockefeller between 1917 and 1920. It was done by William O. Inglis, a New York newspaperman who questioned Rockefeller for an authorized biography that was never published. As I pored over this 1,700-page verbatim transcript, I was astonished. Rockefeller, stereotyped as taciturn and empty, turned out to be analytic, articulate, even fiery. He was also quite funny, with a dry Midwestern wit. This wasn't someone I had encountered in any biography. When I returned home, I told Ann Godoff, my editor at Random House, that I was now eager to do the book. To delve into the voluminous Rockefeller papers is to excavate a lost continent. Yet even with such massive documentation, I had the frustrating sense early in my research that I was confronting a sphinx. Rockefeller trained himself to reveal as little as possible, even in private letters, which he wrote as if they might someday fall into the hands of a prosecuting attorney. With his instinctive secrecy, he excelled at employing strange euphemisms and elliptical phrasing. For this reason, the 20,000 pages of letters that Rockefeller received from his more outspoken business associates proved a windfall of historic proportions. Written as early as 1877, 7 years after Standard Oil's formation, they provide a vivid portrait of the company's Byzantine dealings with oil producers, refiners, transporters, and marketers, as well as railroad chieftains, bank directors, and political bosses. This panorama of greed and guile should startle even the most jaundiced students of the Gilded Age. I was also extremely fortunate to have access to the papers of 5 distinguished predecessors, all of whom left behind complete research files. I combed through the abundant papers of Ida Tarbell at the Drake Well Museum in Titusville, Pennsylvania, Henry Demarest Lloyd at the State Historical Society of Wisconsin, and Alan Nevins at Columbia University, in addition to those of William O. Inglis and Raymond B. Fosdick, the author of the official biography of John D. Rockefeller, Jr., at the Rockefeller Archive Center. These collections contain a vast number of contemporary interviews and other materials that were only partly used by their authors. Like many moguls of the Gilded Age, Rockefeller was either glorified by partisan biographers who could see no wrong, or vilified by vitriolic critics who could see no right. This one-sidedness has been especially harmful in the case of Rockefeller, who was such an implausible blend of sin and sanctity. I have tried to operate in the large space between polemics and apologetics, motivated by the belief that Rockefeller's life was of a piece, and that the pious Bible-thumping Rockefeller wasn't simply a cunning facade for the corporate pirate. The religious and acquisitive sides of his nature were intimately related. For this reason, I have stressed his evangelical baptism as the passkey that unlocks many mysteries of his life. Those who would like to see Rockefeller either demonized or canonized in these pages will be disappointed. This seems an auspicious time to resurrect Rockefeller's ghost. With the fall of trade barriers and the vogue for free market economics, the world is now united by a global marketplace that touches 5 billion souls, with many countries just emerging from Marxist or mercantilist systems and having their first taste of capitalism. The story of John D. Rockefeller transports us back to a time when industrial capitalism was raw and new in America, and the rules of the game were unwritten. More than anyone else, Rockefeller incarnated the capitalist revolution that followed the Civil War and transformed American life. He embodied all its virtues of thrift, self-reliance, hard work, and unflagging enterprise. Yet, as someone who flouted government and rode roughshod over competitors, he also personified many of its most egregious vices. As a result, his career became the focal point for a debate about the proper role of government in the economy that has lasted until the present day. Prelude. Poison Tongue. Reading this book brings back to my mind facts and situations that I had forgotten for years, John D. Rockefeller mused. It digs up things long past and dead so that they stand before me once more alive. I am glad of it, very glad of it. For months, Rockefeller had listened to his authorized biographer read aloud from Henry Demarest Lloyd's Wealth Against Commonwealth, a savage account of his career published in 1894. Now retired and in his late 70s, the world's richest man had reluctantly agreed to reminisce behind closed doors. Starting in 1917, for an hour each morning, Rockefeller fielded questions while slumped in an easy chair or reclining on a lounge in his bedroom at Kaikut, a Georgian mansion set amid the woodland beauty of Westchester County's Pocantico Hills. Serene in his conscience, convinced that God had blessed his career and that the court of history would acquit him, Rockefeller had submitted to this exercise only to please his son, who wanted to cleanse the family name of all controversy. As Rockefeller reminded his appointed Boswell, the affable William O. Inglis, a newspaperman recruited from Rockefeller's old nemesis, the World, "But for the urgent request of my son, who is not familiar with this history, I would never have taken the time and the trouble to make any refutation to these questions." Despite his initial hesitation, Rockefeller couldn't resist the invitation to relive his turbulent early years in the petroleum industry, and he warmed to the giant task of remembrance. During hundreds of hours of interviews, spanning a 3-year period, he revisited the past and spoke his mind freely. At times, he evoked his life in the dulcet tones of a preacher addressing a brotherhood of kindred souls. At other moments, he was dryly sardonic or brutally funny about his critics, though all the while as a good Christian he tried to suppress vengeful feelings toward them. Before Inglis's wondering eyes, the old man was rejuvenated by the flood tide of memory, and his voice deepened from the high breathy pitch of age to the mellow baritone of early adulthood. His step grew springy and lithe as he paced the floor, recounting the glorious struggles of his career. Far from dodging controversy, Rockefeller suggested a novel structure for this retrospective talk. Inglis would read passages from Rockefeller's two chief antagonists, Henry Lloyd and Ida Tarbell, whose influential broadside had been published in the early 1900s, and Rockefeller would refute them paragraph by paragraph. Having dismissed their indictments as beneath his dignity, he hadn't deigned to read them when they first appeared. Now, in a measure of feisty self-confidence, he decided to tackle the toughest charges point blank. "I was averse for 8 months to say anything in response to these foolish writers," he noted, "but now that I've gotten into it, I find it interesting." And once John D. Rockefeller Sr. set his mind to something, he brought awesome powers of concentration to bear. As Rockefeller undertook this extended defense, he clearly believed that he had been vindicated in the time since these journalists had blackened his reputation in the early 1900s and made him America's most hated businessman. "All of those in the business today are doing business along the modern lines, following the plans which we were the first to propose," he said with pride. Public bitterness toward him had waned, he believed, and opposition to his petroleum empire was practically nil and has been for many years, and it has ceased to be popular to raid the Standard Oil Company. Indeed, the American public during World War I appreciated the industrial strength conferred by the Standard Oil Companies, and Rockefeller imagined, with some justice, that his compatriots now viewed him as a public benefactor, not as a corporate buccaneer. The huge philanthropies he had endowed in recent years had also mitigated public animosity toward him. As always with Rockefeller, the pregnant silences in the interview spoke as eloquently as the words. Coached by his publicist, Ivy Lee, Rockefeller eschewed such loaded terms as trust, monopoly, oligopoly, or cartel when referring to Standard Oil, and preferred to speak of cooperation. He expressed scorn for the textbook world of free markets evoked by Adam Smith. What a blessing it was that the idea of cooperation with railroads, with telegraph lines, with steel companies, with oil companies, came in and prevailed to take the place of this chaotic condition in which the virtuous academic know-nothings about business were doing what they construed to be God's service in eating each other up. During the 3-year interview, Rockefeller never once alluded to his most stinging setback, the federal government's 1911 dismemberment of Standard Oil into dozens of constituent companies. Annulling the Supreme Court verdict by a trick of memory, Rockefeller talked of Standard Oil as if the old monolith still stood unscathed. Of all the poses he assumed, perhaps the hardest to maintain was that he bore no grudges against his detractors. He peppered his talk with references to his forgiving nature. "The representatives of the Standard Oil Company cherish most kindly and brotherly feelings even toward those who abused them most, and are ready to lay it to their weakness and ignorance and whatever else was controlling them. Furthermore, and to those who have uttered against them harsh words, we cherish no resentment. To err is human, to forgive divine." And even more conciliatory, "And I rejoice also that we are charitable and sweet-spirited to these jealous small men who made it the business of their lives to try to pull us down because their vision did not extend beyond the ends of their noses." Over time, however, the sacerdotal tone began to falter. Rockefeller couldn't conceive of a genuinely principled objection to his career, and increasingly resorted to ad hominem attacks, deriding his critics as croakers, howlers, grumblers, complainers, blackmailers, pirates, spoiled children, whiners, adventurers, wolves, and freebooters. Clearly, the allegations rankled, especially those of Ida Minerva Tarbell, whose cool, clear-eyed investigative prose had turned his name into a byword for corporate greed. With golf cronies, Rockefeller had poked fun at her, calling her Miss Tarbarrel, but this was a transparent attempt to draw the sting from her words. During the marathon interview, Inglis saw Rockefeller's iron poise and self-mastery crumble only twice, and both times significantly in responding to Tarbell. The first time came when he read aloud her charge that in 1872 the 32-year-old Rockefeller had taken over the Cleveland refineries by threatening to crush rivals who refused to join his cartel. Now, 1872 had been the starting point of his relentless march towards supremacy in oil. If that year was tainted, then everything was. Inglis recorded a graphic account of Rockefeller's reaction to Tarbell's allegation. "That is absolutely false," exclaimed Mr. Rockefeller so loudly that I looked up from the notes. As he spoke, he jumped up from the big chair in which he was reclining and walked over to my table. His face was flushed and his eyes were burning. It was the first time I had ever seen him show any but pleasant feeling, and there could be no doubt that he was aflame with anger and resentment. His voice rang out loud and clear. He did not beat the desk with his fist, but stood there with his hands clenched, controlling himself with evident effort. He could not immediately regain his balance. "This is absolutely false," he cried, "and no man was told that by me or by any of our representatives. You may put that down once and for all. That statement is an absolute lie." After this outburst, Rockefeller's emotions subsided, but the insinuation stung. Later, he and Inglis roamed over the hills and golf fairways of his vast estate. "How ridiculous all that talk is," he exclaimed. "It's twaddle, poisonous twaddle, put out for a purpose. As a matter of fact, we were all in a sinking ship. If existing cutthroat competition continued, and we were trying to build a lifeboat to carry us all to the shore. You don't have to threaten men to get them to leave a sinking ship in a lifeboat." The purchase of his competitors' firms had not been the benevolent act that Rockefeller suggested, but he had a powerfully selective memory. Rockefeller reserved his most bitter epithets for another passage, where Tarbell dealt with the touchiest matter in his personal life. The character of his colorful, raffish father, William Avery Rockefeller. In July 1905, she had capped off her serial history of Standard Oil with a two-part character study of Rockefeller, filled with venomous portrayals of his father, an itinerant peddler of patent medicines who had led a shadowy, vagabond life. William Avery Rockefeller had been the sort of fast-talking huckster who thrived in frontier communities of early 19th-century America, and Tarbell amply reported his misdemeanors. At one point in her blistering portrait, she said, "Indeed, he had all the vices save one. He never drank." This thrust against his dead father probed some buried pain, some still festering wound inside Rockefeller, and he suddenly erupted with explosive fury. "What a wretched utterance from one calling herself a historian!" he jeered, speculating quite incorrectly that Tarbell had been embittered by the failure of her series to dent the Standard Oil empire. "So she turned to this miserable fabrication, with all the sneers, all the malice, all the sly hintings and perversions of which she is master, and with more bitterness than ever attacked my father." Momentarily, Rockefeller couldn't regain his self-control. His famous granite composure had utterly broken down, and for one of the few times in his life, he let forth a torrent of intemperate abuse. Spluttering with rage, he railed against the poison tongue of this poison woman who seeks to poison the public with every endeavor, to cast suspicion on everything good, bad, or indifferent appertaining to a name which has thus far not been ruined by her shafts. Aware that he had uncharacteristically let down his guard, Rockefeller soon checked himself and restored the old pose of philosophic calm, reassuring Inglis in soothing tones, "After all, I am grateful that I do not cherish bitterness even against this historian, but pity." The Titan had regained his dignity, and he made sure that his tightly fitted mask never slipped again in front of his authorized biographer. Chapter 1. The Flim-Flam Man. In the early 1900s, as Rockefeller vied with Andrew Carnegie for the title of the world's richest man, a spirited rivalry arose between France and Germany, with each claiming to be Rockefeller's ancestral land. Assorted genealogists stood ready, for a sizable fee, to manufacture a splendid royal lineage for the oil man. "I have no desire to trace myself back to the nobility," he said honestly. "I am satisfied with my good old American stock." The most ambitious search for Rockefeller's roots traced them back to a 9th-century French family, the Roquefeuille, who supposedly inhabited a Languedoc chateau, a charming story that unfortunately has been refuted by recent findings. In contrast, the Rockefellers' German lineage has been clearly established in the Rhine Valley dating back to at least the early 1600s. Around 1723, Johann Peter Rockefeller, a miller, gathered up his wife and five children, set sail for Philadelphia, and settled on a farm in Somerville, and then Amwell, New Jersey, where he evidently flourished and acquired large landholdings. More than a decade later, his cousin Diehl Rockefeller left southwest Germany and moved to Germantown, New York. Diehl's granddaughter Christina married her distant relative William, one of Johann's grandsons. Never particularly sentimental about his European forebears, John D. Rockefeller did erect a monument to the patriarch, Johann Peter, at his burial site in Flemington, New Jersey. The marriage of William and Christina produced a son named Godfrey Rockefeller, who was the grandfather of the oil titan and a most unlikely progenitor of the clan. In 1806, Godfrey married Lucy Avery in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, despite the grave qualms of her family. Establishing a pattern that would be replicated by Rockefeller's own mother, Lucy had, in her family's disparaging view, married down. Her ancestors had emigrated from Devon, England, to Salem, Massachusetts, around 1630, forming part of the Puritan tide. As they became settled and gentrified, the versatile Averys spawned ministers, soldiers, civic leaders, explorers, and traders, not to mention a bold clutch of Indian fighters. During the American Revolution, 11 Averys perished gloriously in the Battle of Groton. While the Rockefellers' noble roots required some poetic license and liberal embellishment, Lucy could justly claim descent from Edmund Ironside, the English king who was crowned in 1016. Godfrey Rockefeller was sadly mismatched with his enterprising wife. He had a stunted, impoverished look and a hangdog air of perpetual defeat. Taller than her husband, a fiery Baptist of commanding presence, Lucy was raw-boned and confident, with a vigorous step and alert blue eyes. A former schoolteacher, she was better educated than Godfrey. Even John Dee, never given to invidious comments about relatives, tacitly conceded, "My grandmother was a brave woman. Her husband was not so brave as she." If Godfrey contributed the Rockefeller coloring, bluish-gray eyes, light brown hair, Lucy introduced the rangy frame later notable among the men. Enjoying robust energy and buoyant health, Lucy had 10 children, with the third, William Avery Rockefeller, born in Granger, New York in 1810. While it is easy enough to date the birth of Rockefeller's father, teams of frazzled reporters would one day exhaust themselves trying to establish the date of his death. As a farmer and businessman, Godfrey enjoyed checkered success, and his aborted business ventures exposed his family to an insecure, peripatetic life. They were forced to move to Granger and Ancrum, New York, then to Great Barrington, before doubling back to Livingston, New York. John D. Rockefeller's upbringing would be fertile with cautionary figures of weak men gone astray. Godfrey must have been invoked frequently as a model to be avoided. By all accounts, Grandpa was a jovial, good-natured man, but feckless and addicted to drink, producing in Lucy an everlasting hatred of liquor that she must have drummed into her grandson. Grandpa Godfrey was the first to establish in John Dee's mind an enduring equation between bonhomie and lax character, making the latter prefer the society of sober, tight-lipped men in full command of their emotions. The Rockefeller records offer various scenarios of why Godfrey and Lucy packed their belongings into an overloaded Conestoga wagon and headed west between 1832 and 1834. By one account, the Rockefellers, along with several neighbors, were dispossessed of their land in a heated title dispute with some English investors. Another account has an unscrupulous businessman gulling Godfrey into swapping his farm for allegedly richer turf in Tioga County. If this claim was in fact made, it proved a cruel hoax. Some relatives later said that Michigan was Godfrey's real destination, but that Lucy vetoed such a drastic relocation, preferring the New England culture of upstate New York to the wilds of Michigan. Whatever the reason, the Rockefellers reenacted the primordial American right of setting out in search of fresh opportunity. In the 1830s, many settlers from Massachusetts and Connecticut were swarming excitedly into wilderness areas of western New York, a migration that Alexis de Tocqueville described as a game of chance, pursued for the emotions it excites as much as for the gain it procures. The construction of the Erie Canal in the 1820s had lured many settlers to the area. Godfrey and Lucy heaped up their worldly possessions in a canvas-topped prairie schooner drawn by oxen and headed toward the sparsely settled territory. For 2 weeks they traveled along the dusty Albany-Catskill Turnpike, creeping through forests as darkly forbidding as the setting of a Grimm's fairy tale. With much baggage and little passenger space, the Rockefellers had to walk for much of the journey, with Lucy and the children, except William, who did not accompany them, taking turns sitting in the wagon whenever they grew weary. As they finally reached their destination, Richford, New York, the last 3.5 miles were especially arduous, and the oxen negotiated the stony, rutted path with difficulty. At the end, they had to lash their exhausted team up a nearly vertical hillside to possess their virgin 60 acres. As family legend has it, Godfrey got out, tramped to the property's peak, inspected the vista, and said mournfully, "This is as close as we shall ever get to Michigan." So, in a memorial to dashed hopes, the spot would forever bear the melancholy name of Michigan Hill. Even today, scarcely more than a crossroads, Richford was then a stagecoach stop in the wooded country southeast of Ithaca and northwest of Binghamton. The area's original inhabitants, the Iroquois, had been chased out after the American Revolution and replaced by Revolutionary Army veterans. Still an uncouth frontier when the Rockefellers arrived, this backwater had recently attained township status, its village square dating from 1821. Civilization had taken only a tenuous hold. The dense forests on all sides teemed with game, bear, deer, panther, wild turkey, and cottontail rabbit, and people carried flaring torches at night to frighten away the roaming packs of wolves. By the time that John D. Rockefeller was born in 1839, Richford was acquiring the amenities of a small town. It had some nascent industries, sawmills, grist mills, and a whiskey distillery, plus a schoolhouse and a church. Most inhabitants scratched out a living from hardscrabble farming, yet these newcomers were hopeful and enterprising. Notwithstanding their frontier trappings, they had carried with them the frugal culture of Puritan New England, which John D. Rockefeller would come to exemplify. The Rockefellers' steep property provided a sweeping panorama of a fertile valley. The vernal slopes were spattered with wildflowers, and chestnuts and berries abounded in the fall. Amid this sylvan beauty, the Rockefellers had to struggle with a Spartan life. They occupied a small plain house, 22 feet deep and 16 feet across, fashioned with hand-hewn beams and timbers. The thin soil was so rocky that it required heroic exertions just to hack a clearing through the underbrush and across thickly forested slopes of pines, hemlock, oak, and maple. As best we can gauge from a handful of surviving anecdotes, Lucy ably managed both family and farm and never shirked heavy toil. Assisted by a pair of steers, she laid an entire stone wall by herself and had the quick-witted cunning and cool resourcefulness that would reappear in her grandson. John D. delighted in telling how she pounced upon a grain thief in their dark barn one night. Unable to discern the intruder's face, she had the mental composure to snip a piece of fabric from his coat sleeve. When she later spotted the man's frayed coat, she confronted the flabbergasted thief with the missing swatch. Having silently made her point, she never pressed charges. One last item about Lucy deserves mention. She had great interest in herbal medicines and home-brewed remedies prepared from a physic bush in the backyard. Many years later, her curious grandson sent specimens of this bush to a laboratory to see whether they possessed genuine medicinal value. Perhaps it was from Lucy that he inherited the fascination with medicine that ran through his life, right up to his creation of the world's preeminent medical research institute. By the time he was in his mid-twenties, William Avery Rockefeller was already a sworn foe of conventional morality, who had opted for a vagabond existence. Even as an adolescent, he disappeared on long trips in midwinter, providing no clues as to his whereabouts. Throughout his life, he expended considerable energy on tricks and schemes to avoid plain hard work. But he possessed such brash charm and rugged good looks. He was nearly 6 feet tall, with a broad chest, high forehead, and thick auburn beard covering a pugnacious jaw, that people were instantly beguiled by him. This appealing facade, at least for a while, lulled skeptics and disarmed critics. It wasn't surprising that this nomad did not accompany his parents on their westward trek to Richford, but instead drifted into the area around 1835 in his own inimitable fashion. When he first appeared in a neighboring hamlet, he quickly impressed the locals with his unorthodox style. Posing as a deaf-mute peddler selling cheap novelties, he kept a small slate with the words, "I am deaf and dumb," chalked across it, tied by a string to his buttonhole. On this slate he conversed with the locals and later boasted how he exploited this ruse to flush out all the town's secrets. To win the confidence of strangers and soften them up for the hard sell, he toted along a kaleidoscope, inviting people to peer into it. During his long career as a confidence man, Big Bill always risked reprisals from people who might suddenly unmask his deceptions, and he narrowly escaped detection at the home of a Deacon Wells. The deacon and his daughter, a Mrs. Smith, pitied the poor peddler who knocked on their door one Saturday and sheltered him in their home that night. The next morning, when they invited him to church, Big Bill had to resort to some fancy footwork, for he always shied away from crowds where somebody might recognize him and expose his imposture. Billy told the deacon in writing that he liked to go to church, but that his infirmity caused him to be stared at, so that he was abashed and would not go, recalled a townsman. He really feared that he might be exposed by someone. 7 months later, after the deacon and Big Bill had both moved to Richford, Mrs. Smith spotted the erstwhile deaf-mute at a social gathering and marveled at his miraculous recovery of speech. "I see that you can talk better than when I saw you last," she said. Big Bill smiled, unfazed, his bravado intact. "Yes, I'm somewhat improved." When he arrived in Richford, the local citizens immediately got a taste of his fakery, for he wordlessly flashed a slate with the scribbled query, "Where is the house of Godfrey Rockefeller?" Since he usually presented false claims about himself and his products, Bill worked a large territory to elude the law. He was roving more than 30 miles northwest of Richford, in the vicinity of Niles and Moravia, when he first met his future wife, Eliza Davison, at her father's farmhouse. With a flair for showmanship and self-promotion, he always wore brocaded vests or other brightly colored duds that must have dazzled a sheltered farm girl like Eliza. Like many itinerant vendors in rural places, he was a smooth-talking purveyor of dreams along with tawdry trinkets, and Eliza responded to this romantic wanderer. She was sufficiently taken in by his deaf-and-dumb humbug that she involuntarily exclaimed in his presence, "I'd marry that man if he were not deaf-and-dumb." Whatever tacit doubts she might have harbored when she discovered his deceit, she soon succumbed, as did other women, to his mesmerizing charm. A prudent, straight-laced Baptist of Scotch-Irish descent, deeply attached to his daughter, John Davison must have sensed the world of trouble that awaited Eliza if she got mixed up with Big Bill Rockefeller, and he strongly discouraged the match. In later years, Eliza Rockefeller would seem to be a dried-up, withered spinster, but in late 1836 she was a slim, spirited young woman with flaming red hair and blue eyes. Pious and self-contained, she was the antithesis of Bill and probably found him so hypnotic for just that reason. Who knows what gloom hung around her doorstep that was dispelled by Bill's glib patter. Her mother had died when Eliza was only 12. She had dropped dead after taking a pill dispensed by a traveling doctor. And Eliza was raised by her older sister, Mary Ann, leaving Eliza deprived of maternal counsel. On February 18, 1837, despite the express opposition of John Davison, this most improbable couple, Bill was 27, Eliza 24, were wed at the home of one of Eliza's friends. The marriage was a favorite gossip item among the Richford townspeople, who tended to spy guile on Bill's part. Compared to the Davisons, the Rockefellers were poor country folk, and it is very likely that Bill was entranced by reports of John Davison's modest wealth. As early as 1801, the frugal Davison had acquired 150 acres in Cayuga County. In John Dee's words, "My grandfather was a rich man, that is, for his time he was counted rich. In those days, one who had his farm paid for and had a little money beside was counted rich. 4 or 5 or 6 thousand was counted rich. My grandfather had perhaps 3 or 4 times that. He had money to lend." Most Richford residents believed that Big Bill's meeting with Eliza was less a random encounter than a premeditated bid to snare her father's money. A notorious cad who regarded every pretty young woman as a potential conquest, Bill had at least one serious romance that antedated his wooing of Eliza. As Ralph P. Smith, a longtime Richford resident, recalled, "Billy was unmarried when he came here, and it was supposed that he would marry Nancy Brown, who was his housekeeper, but he broke with her, settling a sum said to have been about $400 on her when he concluded to win the daughter of the rich John Davison over at Niles, on the outskirts of Moravia." The story is corroborated by John Dee's cousin, Mrs. John Wilcox, who said, "Nancy Brown of Harford Mills was a beautiful girl, remarkably beautiful. William fell in love with her. She was poor. William would have money. Eliza Davison's father was to give her $500 when she married, so William married her." This marriage, consummated under false pretenses, fused the lives of two highly dissimilar personalities, setting the stage for all the future heartache, marital discord, and chronic instability that would so powerfully mold the contradictory personality of John D. Rockefeller. When Bill brought his bride back to the Richford house he'd built half a mile from his parents' place, Eliza must have pondered the wisdom of her father's disapproval. Life promised to be hard and flinty in this rough-hewn homestead. Surviving photos of John D. Rockefeller's birthplace show a plain, clapboard house set on a treeless slope, outlined bleakly against the sky. The rude dwelling looked like two attached boxcars, the austere simplicity broken only by a small awning over one door. However primitive the exterior, the snug house was solidly built out of timber from local forests. The main floor had 2 bedrooms and a living room, topped by a low sleeping loft and attic storage room. The little attached building served as a barn and woodshed. This bucolic birth site of the future kerosene king was probably lit by sperm oil or tallow candles. The grounds were much more ample than the house, as the 50-acre lot included an apple orchard and a trout-filled stretch of Owego Creek, which bubbled along the bottom of the property. Before long, Big Bill roughly disabused Eliza of any high-flown romantic notions she might have had about matrimony. Far from renouncing his girlfriend, Nancy Brown, he brought her into the cramped house as a housekeeper, and began having children alternately by wife and mistress. In 1838, Eliza gave birth to their first child, Lucy, followed a few months later by Nancy's first illegitimate daughter, Clorinda. On the night of July 8, 1839, Bill and Eliza again summoned the midwife, this time to deliver a boy, who came into the world in a bare front bedroom measuring 8 by 10 feet. This child, born during Martin Van Buren's presidency and destined to become the country's foremost capitalist, would survive into the second term of Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal. Like many other future magnates, Andrew Carnegie, born in 1835, Jay Gould, 1836, and J. Pierpont Morgan, 1837, he was born in the late 1830s and would therefore come to maturity on the eve of the post-Civil War industrial boom. Several months after John's birth, Nancy Brown gave birth to a second daughter, Cornelia, which meant that Bill, lord of his own harem, managed to sire four children under one roof in just 2 years. Thus, the fiercely moralistic John Davison Rockefeller, appropriately named after Eliza's sober father, was sandwiched tightly between two illegitimate sisters, born into a situation steeped in sin. Eliza couldn't have been very comfortable with her in-laws. In general, the Rockefellers were a hard-drinking hillbilly clan, sociable and funny, fond of music, liquor, and uproarious good times, and adhering to a coarse frontier morality. As the strong matriarch, Lucy was the conspicuous exception, and Eliza drew close to her while frowning upon many of her more dissipated in-laws. During the Richford period, Bill's younger brother, Miles Avery Rockefeller, deserted his wife and decamped to South Dakota with Ella Brousse, a young woman who had done domestic work for Eliza. In a move that prefigured a future stratagem for Bill, Miles entered into a bigamous marriage with Ella and adopted his middle name as his new surname. Such recreated lives were common at a time when America had a vast, unmapped frontier and numerous sanctuaries from the law. For a callow farm girl fresh from home, Eliza proved unexpectedly tolerant of Nancy Brown. Contrary to what one might expect, she pitied this intruder, perhaps considering the cramped ménage à trois fit punishment for having flouted her father's advice. As her niece observed, Aunt Eliza loved her husband and she liked poor Nancy, but Aunt Eliza's brothers came down and made William put Nancy away. In this period of Eliza's marriage, Mr. Davison is conspicuous by his absence, leaving one to wonder whether he had temporarily washed his hands of his disobedient daughter, or whether, cowed by guilt and embarrassment, she had hidden her troubles from him. By one account, when Nancy grew quarrelsome after Bill's marriage, he seized the chance to expel his shrewish mistress from the packed household. Heeding the pleas from the Davisons, he posted Nancy and the two daughters to live with her parents in nearby Harford Mills. Family legend claims that Bill, who had a weak but not entirely dormant conscience, secretly deposited clothing bundles on her doorstep. Fortunately, the years with Bill didn't blight Nancy's life, for she married a man named Burlingame, bore other children, and furnished her first two daughters with a respectable upbringing. From the skimpy documentary evidence, we know that Clorinda died young, while Cornelia grew up into a tall, smart, attractive school teacher with a telling resemblance to Big Bill. Sometimes he acceded to her demands for money, but there were strict limits to Bill's generosity, and he would rebuff her when she became too clamorous. Cornelia married a man named Sexton and remained in the Richford area, but only a few local residents and Rockefeller relatives knew that she was John D.'s half-sister. To her credit, Cornelia never tried to cash in on her kinship with the world's richest man, perhaps because it would unavoidably have advertised her illegitimacy. It is impossible to determine whether Rockefeller ever knew of the existence of his two illegitimate half-sisters. The Nancy Brown affair wasn't the only indignity visited upon Eliza, for she was often abandoned by Bill during her three cheerless years in Richford. He remained a restless and defiant individualist who preferred life beyond the pale of society. Early in the marriage, he stayed put for a while, operating a small sawmill on Michigan Hill and dealing in salt, fur, horses, and timber. But he soon resumed the footloose life of a peddler, his trips cloaked in unfathomable mystery. Like a fugitive, he would depart furtively under cover of night and return after dark, weeks or months later, flinging pebbles at the window to signal his return. To tide over his family in his absence, he arranged for credit at the general store. "Give my family anything they want while I'm away," he instructed Chauncey Rich, whose father, Ezekiel, had founded Richford. "And when I come back, I'll settle." Never knowing when this credit might be canceled, Eliza became extremely frugal and drilled her children in thrifty maxims, such as, "Willful waste makes woeful want." When Bill returned home, a sudden smiling apparition, he would be riding new horses, wearing fine clothes, and brandishing a thick wad of crisp bills. Before going to see Eliza, he would pay off Chauncey Rich so that he could confidently tell her everything was now squared away at the store. His seductive charm melted away whatever hostility his absence had aroused. It took time before his extended absences and repeated betrayals burned the romance out of her system, leaving a residue of stoic resignation. For the moment, whatever her anxieties or loneliness, she seemed girlishly lovelorn during his trips, still smitten with her flim-flam man. "Just look at that moon," she once sighed to a cousin when Bill was on the road. "Is William, miles and miles away, perhaps looking at it too at this moment? I do hope he is." On the road, Bill improvised ever more fanciful ways to make money. A crack shot, he made the circuit of shooting contests, often bringing home prize money. A glad-handing huckster, he sold rings and other knick-knacks at fantastic markups. Mostly, though, he styled himself a botanic physician or herbal doctor, euphemisms faithfully parroted by some Rockefeller descendants. At a time when physicians still resorted to bleeding, blistering, and violent purgatives, and many rustic areas lacked access to medical care, such traveling salesmen filled a vacuum. Nevertheless, in William Avery Rockefeller, one clearly detects the blarney and easy conviviality of the mountebank. Sometimes he peddled bottles of home-brewed elixir or patent medicines bought from druggists, but he scored his greatest success with natural medicines culled from Lucy's physic bush. Though his mother had a sincere interest in herbal remedies, Bill would grossly distort or exaggerate their properties. For instance, he harvested small purplish berries from her garden that resembled small pills, and would hawk them to farmers' wives as a sovereign remedy for stomach troubles. His sales pitch went even further, for, as a Richford neighbor reported many years later, he would warn them solemnly that they must not be given to a woman in a delicate condition, for they would surely cause abortion. Thereupon, he would sell his pills at a high price. They were perfectly harmless, and he broke no law in selling them. He had remarkable imagination. The midnight rambles and peculiar commerce of William Rockefeller mystified the Richford citizenry. He both fired and troubled the imagination, generating so much gossip and speculation that they christened him Devil Bill. Rumors raced periodically through town that he was a gambler, a horse thief, a desperado. Though he seemed to operate on the edge of the law, people were delighted by his bluff humor and tall tales, if dismayed by his treatment of his family. "When he finally succeeded as a peddler, he would dress up like a prince and kept everyone wondering," said one town resident who participated in the guessing game about Bill's manifold sources of income. "He laughed a great deal and enjoyed the speculation he caused. He was not a drinking man and treated his family well when he was home, but everyone knew that he neglected the family by leaving them to shift for themselves for long months at a time. He frustrated those neighbors who ached for his comeuppance. After one prolonged absence of several months, when Eliza's bill at Chauncey Rich's topped $1,000, the scuttlebutt said that Devil Bill had been arrested. Instead, like a country squire, he came trotting into town in a magnificent carriage, seated behind a team of splendid horses, diamonds glittering in his shirt front. At the general store, he made a point of settling the tab with large bills. After such trips, Bill gathered friends and family around the dinner table and, while wolfing down heaps of food, would regale them with picaresque tales of his adventures among the western settlers and Indians. Devil Bill had a knack for weaving his experiences into spellbinding narratives, making Eliza and the children vicarious partners in his travels. As the chief casualty of Bill's peregrinations, Eliza received sympathy from her neighbors, who felt she was being abused by her husband. Yet she remained loyal to him, declined many opportunities to denigrate him, and carried herself with considerable dignity. However overblown the frequent biographical claims about John D. Rockefeller's impoverished childhood have been, several people testified to the family's squalor in Richford. "I do not remember ever to have seen more pitiably neglected children," one neighbor observed. "Their clothing was old and tattered, and they looked dirty and hungry." It was a measure of Eliza's desperation that she sought relief in the home of her brother-in-law, Jacob Rockefeller, a bawdy, jolly, not infrequently besotted man. An oft-told tale about Jacob recounted how he won a $5 bet by staying sober during an entire trip to town. Jacob's kindly wife became a second mother to the two toddlers, Lucy and John, darning their clothes and knitting them mittens from woolen homespun. In this nightmarish situation, Eliza seemed to draw strength from adversity. One Richford native praised her as a most excellent woman, but one who bore too heavy a burden at that time properly to look after her children. Her husband was away for long periods, and she had to look after their farm of 60 acres and try to make it pay their expenses. She did not know at what time the shopkeepers of the village might shut down on her credit, and she worked very hard. When John D. later evoked his idyllic sunlit boyhood in upstate New York, he blotted out Richford from those reveries. Just 3 when he left there, he retained only a few hazy memories of the place. "I remember very clearly the brook that ran near the front of the house and how careful I had to be to keep far away from it. I remember my mother vaguely at Richford and my grandmother, who lived half a mile or so up the hill." One notes that Rockefeller's earliest memory was associated with caution, and that he edited out the absentee father and inebriated grandfather, while retaining the strong, enduring mother and grandmother. He always possessed an unusual self-protective capacity to suppress unpleasant memories and keep alive those things that fortified his resolve. As best we can tell, Rockefeller knew nothing of Nancy Brown and the seamy side of Richford existence, yet he carried through life a vague sense of an infernal place. "I shudder to think of what I should have been if I had remained in Richford all my life," he later confided. "There were many men who hunt a little, fish a little, and drink whiskey a little, and only attain a little success in life, and all for the lack of a little religion." Of his family's decision to leave Richford, Rockefeller offered an economic explanation that probably served as the standard cover story of his childhood. Stingy soil. "The country there is beautiful," Rockefeller would say, "but the settlers wasted their energy in trying to get the stumps out of the ground and trying to make crops grow in the poor soil." The true reason, of course, was Eliza's horror at the town's low moral tone, as reflected by its single church. She was probably also eager to remove the children from the influence of her boisterous, drunken Rockefeller in-laws and expose them to the steadier Davisons. By no coincidence, the Rockefellers moved to Moravia, 3 miles from the Davison farm, where Eliza could enjoy her father's presence during her husband's habitual absences. Chapter 2. Fires of Revival. When the Rockefellers moved 30 miles north from Richford to Moravia, they progressed from a backward frontier settlement to a more sedate community with neat frame houses in the town center. Settled by the United Brethren in Christ, an evangelical denomination that later merged with the United Methodist Church, Moravia was already a stronghold of temperance and anti-slavery sentiment, and boasted a hotel, general store, cotton mill, and congregational church. Even today, Moravia is a quaintly authentic piece of Americana, with graceful shady streets that have a companionable feel, and houses with wide, friendly verandas. The Rockefellers lived on the rural outskirts north of town. Around 1843, Bill put down $1,000 for a 92-acre parcel of grassy upland that gently sloped down to Owasco Lake, one of the most picturesque of the Finger Lakes. He enlarged an existing house until it contained 7 or 8 rooms favored with superb views, framed by tall pines, of the bright blue lake set against a backdrop of wooded hills on the far shore. Barns stood across the road, and a smokehouse out back enabled the family to cure ham and bacon. For John D., this 2-story clapboard house was a scene of enchantment, and became his enduring emblem of pastoral beauty. In the summertime, he loved to pull yellow perch from the cold, clear lake, and even winters captivated him in spite of the bitter cold. The Rockefeller children slept in an unplastered upstairs room that was heated only by a stovepipe rising from the kitchen. Snow flurries and sharp winter squalls pressed through cracks in the walls. "How the wind used to roar among the hemlocks by the shore of the lake," Rockefeller remembered dreamily in his late 70s. In the pre-dawn dark, the children were often awakened by the sharp chopping of woodcutters or the squeal of sleds on hard-packed snow. Eliza would stand at the foot of the stairs and call up to her eldest son, Come, my son, time to get up and milk your cow. To warm his feet in the dim, cold barn, John always stood on the steaming earth just vacated by the cow he was milking. The first three Rockefeller children, Lucy, John, and William, had been born in Richford. Now, in 1843, with Big Bill again on the road during months of her pregnancy, Eliza gave birth to a second daughter, Mary Ann. 2 years later, twins arrived. The boy, Frank, was healthy, but Frances was sickly from birth and received some 70 visits from a local doctor before she died just short of her second birthday. Eliza tried to protect the 7-year-old John D. from this first lacerating brush with death, but it remained engraved in his memory. When he visited Moravia as an old man in his 80s, he pointed to a field and explained that, "When Francis was buried, I was sent over to that field to pick stones, so that I should not know." He later exhibited an unacknowledged dread of death, and Eliza was perhaps the first to intuit it. In Moravia, William Avery Rockefeller acted like a strange amalgam of solid citizen and engaging ne'er-do-well. As in Richford, the townsfolk goggled as he sped by on swift horses, decked out in smart clothes, and his prodigal spending sometimes fostered the impression that he was the town's richest man. Mary Ann later dismissed the ridiculous stories of their childhood poverty. "We always had plenty to eat and wear, and every reasonable kind of comfort. We were not rich, of course, far from it. But we had enough to eat and use and save, always." Moravia was the golden period of John's boyhood when his father briefly aspired to gentility. One neighbor even labeled Bill about the most notable man in the community. Since the region was rich in pristine pine forests, he organized a legitimate and quite successful logging business. Before dawn, guided only by starlight and lanterns, he and his work gangs carted logs to the lakeside by bobsled, then floated them up to Auburn, situated at the lake's northern tip. In a sudden burst of civic spirit, Bill helped to select the site for the town's school by counting the revolutions of his buggy wheels as he drove through town, then placing the school at the exact middle of the community. He persuaded local taxpayers to pay for it at a time when many people still thought families should educate their children at home. With the resourceful, go-getter attitude later transmitted to his son, Bill also stocked Owasco Lake with pickerel and even headed the local temperance committee. "That's the kind of man he was," boasted John D. "He'd get a thing done while his neighbors were beginning to talk about it." The Moravia period revealed an important truth about Bill. He had an underlying craving for respectability, and probably didn't plan to spend his whole life as a floating charlatan, preying on the gullible. Bill never deigned to dirty his hands with farm work, of course, which he considered beneath his dignity. He hired a railroad worker named Hiram Odell to work the farm and look after his family during his still frequent wanderings. As Bill instructed him, "Their mother ain't strong enough to manage 'em, and they need some managing. Do just what you think is right for 'em." While Odell cultivated the garden in his spare time, Eliza assigned chores to the children. Drawing a string across the garden one day, she told the two oldest boys, "John, you take care of this side of the string, and Will, this side is yours." In contrast to his father's disdain for manual labor, John, always a self-styled son of the common people, gloried in the rigors of country life, which, he came to believe, toughened him for later industrial struggle. His frugal boyhood hardened an already stoic nature and made him proof against later adversity. There was enough economic activity in the America of the 1840s to stimulate the fancy of any future mogul. Banks sprang up everywhere, canals cross-hatched the countryside, steamboats plied the rivers, railroads and telegraphs welded together the first national markets. Territorial expansion was in the air. Texas was annexed in 1845, and war with Mexico seemed inevitable. Though only dimly aware of such distant developments, John D. Rockefeller already seemed a perfect specimen of Homo economicus. Even as a boy, he bought candy by the pound, divided it into small portions, then sold it at a tidy profit to his siblings. By age 7, encouraged by his mother, he was dropping gold, silver, and copper coins that he earned into a blue china bowl on the mantel. John's first business coup came at age 7, when he shadowed a turkey hen as it waddled off into the woods, raided its nest, and raised the chicks for sale. To spur his enterprise, Eliza gave him milk curds to feed the turkeys, and the next year he raised an even larger brood. As an old man, Rockefeller said, "To this day I enjoy the sight of a flock of turkeys, and never miss an opportunity of studying them." Despite Rockefeller's roseate memories, early photos of him tell a much more somber tale. His face was grim, expressionless, lacking boyish joy and animation. The skin is drawn, the eyes blank and devoid of luster. To other people, he often seemed abstracted, and they remembered him with a deadpan face, trudging along country roads, lost in thought, as if unraveling deep problems. "He was a quiet boy," said one Moravia resident. "He seemed always to be thinking." In many respects, John was